London Underground, a gateway to the capital that transports us to the city's finest buildings, history, and monuments.
This station is Waterloo. Change here for Waterloo, Jubilee, and Waterloo.
From Big Ben to Waterloo, it's a simple 1 minute stop, which is a blink of time compared to the journey passengers on board MV Empire Windrush endured. Years ago, 1,027 people travelled for 22 days from the Caribbean to Great Britain to settle in and to help rebuild a war-torn Britain. During the Second World War, approximately 16,000 Black and Caribbean men and women volunteered to serve. Some 6,000 served in the RAF, including hundreds as aircrew in roles such as pilots, navigators, engineers, gunners, and wireless operators.
The train at Clapham 6 is the 1557 Southwestern Railway service to Strawberry Hill.
Towering above me at Waterloo Station is the National Windrush Monument, featuring a family dressed in their Sunday best, holding hands with suitcases in tow. A permanent statue reflecting on the contribution of the Windrush generation who arrived in Britain between 1948 and 1971.
I am Basil Watson, artist, sculptor, and author of the National Windrush Monument. Well, it was my first return to London, to England, since leaving as a toddler of age around 4 years old, three, four. So it was a remembrance piece. It connected me with the stories, a lot of the Jamaican culture. The idea of the suitcase came from the journey of the Windrush generation. It carried with them their hopes, aspirations, their values, and it carried every solution that they needed resided in that suitcase. So, it really represents, the suitcases represent their foundation and their heritage and their dreams and their values.
Of course, there's so many words of inspiration when it comes to this monument. What does that phrase mean to you, Journey of Remembrance, for the Windrush Memorial that you've built?
Well, we have to remember where we are from in order to fully or properly chart where we are going and who we understand who we are. And I think it's important that we remember the sacrifices, the efforts, the vision that was made by our forefathers. And every community needs this type of remembrance. And for the Windrush generation, it is very important, very touching to understand where our parents and grandparents came from, their aspirations, what they have sacrificed. And this will hopefully inspire us to continue the journey, make the next steps. And also when we're faced with hard decisions about moving forward, this is an inspiration that others have come from far and have traveled far and have gone a long way. And they too can continue to push forward and be brave.
BFBS, the Forces Station.
The Benson War Memorial stands high on the corner of Church and Oxford Road in Benson, looking out towards Castle Square. It was awarded Best Kept Village War Memorial 2 years running in 1964 and 65. One of the men commemorated at the site is Lieutenant Colonel John Henry Bridcutt, DSO, and on a rainy November morning, I met with David Rushton, a volunteer at the Soldiers of Oxfordshire Museum, to hear his story.
Not many men join the British Army as a humble private and rise to the rank of Lieutenant Colonel in charge of a whole battalion of men, but John Henry Bridcutt did exactly that. John Henry was born in Roke, a little farming hamlet near Benson, in 1874. In 1893, he joined the Coldstream Guards as a private. John had some initial early problems with discipline, but promotion was very rapid. He was a corporal inside 3 years, a sergeant in five, colour sergeant in six, and remarkably was made sergeant major after just 8 years' service. He served with distinction in the Boer War, had two mentions in dispatches, and was clearly regarded as an exceptional soldier. In August 1914, John Henry Bridcut was commissioned, but he went straight to the Western Front, and within months he'd been promoted to temporary captain. John was captain and adjutant of the Bedfords when they went over the top, 1st of July 1916, the Battle of the Somme. The 7th Bedfords took 320 casualties that day, roughly one-third of the men. But Captain Bridcut survived, and his bravery was rewarded, again by being mentioned in dispatches. His abilities and outstanding service record were recognised when he was promoted to Lieutenant Colonel and given the command of the 2nd Battalion, Royal Irish Rifles. It was this battalion that he led into action the next year near Ypres in Belgium, the last major British offensive of the war. Heavy mist descended. Next morning, as the mist started to part, Lieutenant Colonel Bridcut gallantly attempted to reorganise his men to renew the attack. Sadly, he was killed by a machine gun in the attempt to do so. He died on the 1st of October 1918, just weeks away from the armistice, which ended the war. John Henry Bridcut was one of five brothers. Two others also died in the conflict. It had been a really hard war for the Bridcut family.
A busy area for traffic, but on Remembrance Sunday, time stops as people gather to pay their respects in the village.
On Remembrance Day, all the roads are blocked off, peace descends, only broken at 11 o'clock when we always have a flypast from the RAF's helicopters over our heads. All the usual organisations are there, the scouts, the guides, the cubs. There's a strong contingent from RAF Benson who always turn out very smartly on parade. And the whole event is run by one of their warrant officers in charge of the whole proceedings.
I think there's something quite poignant about the thought that during those 2 minutes of silence, when you're having that reflection, having that fly past, it kind of connects you to those that were in the trenches that potentially never really got complete silence.
Indeed, having the fly past does give you that extra dimension to it. It really brings it home to you. There is quite an atmosphere. Immediately after, the helicopter noise zooms off into the distance.
We're here at the Aldershot Military Cemetery on a rather cold and wet November evening, and we're stood here at the top of the hill, and you know what? It is just incredibly peaceful.
It really is, isn't it? I mean, considering that we're surrounded by an army camp, various industrial units and main roads, it's probably one of the most peaceful places around Aldershot.
From here where we're stood at the moment, surrounded by military war graves, we can see the main road, but not only that, there's actually an abandoned railway line.
Well, what you've got just at the bottom of the hill there is a spur that comes off of the main Aldershot-London line, and that went into what is now Goose Green Housing Estate, and that was called Government Sidings. So in the First World War, there's hundreds of thousands of troops training at Aldershot. When you'd finished your basic training, you left Aldershot, you entrained here at Government Sidings, and you went down to Southampton, Portsmouth, and off you went to the front line. And then there was the journey back home. Those that had severe injuries, or what was called a blighty, they were marked to come back to England to be treated at one of the four military hospitals here at Aldershot. The hospital trains would come in the very small hours of the morning, so 2-3 o'clock in the morning, and there'd be 500 men a time on each of the trains. And the reason they brought them in the small hours is so that it wouldn't affect the morale of the hundreds of thousands of troops who were stationed around here. If they'd have seen these maimed men with limbs missing and suffering from poison gas attacks, etc., it would probably put them off going to war. So that was the method and the madness behind that. There were tunnels, or there was a triage built underground over to the right where the men were assessed, and depending on what they were suffering, that dictated which one of the four hospitals they would go to. And then sadly, many of them did die from their injuries, and they were immediately dispatched here to the cemetery and buried.
It's an incredibly sad and poignant moment to be stood here right now. You know, we've approached where you're talking about that these men were buried. It's over 600 graves.
692 from the First World War. This is the thing that gets me. These guys, they didn't fall with their comrades in arms in the fields of Flanders. They didn't fall in France. They were injured and they were sent back, and then they subsequently died of their injuries. But they weren't returned back to their villages and towns with their loved ones. They remain here at Aldershot for all eternity. And we kind of forget about these people. We're well aware of the big military cemeteries in France and Belgium, but not what we've got here at Aldershot. And I think that's rather sad. And we need to remember them. And this is why we like the graves.
You know, as we walk around the graves here, I think one thing that strikes me is how young some of these people were.
I found two 16-year-olds, both obviously gave false names and dates of birth to enlist. There are just dozens and dozens and dozens between 18 and 24, and that really gets me. The oldest one I've found is 55 from the First World War. Eliza Granger lost two sons and her husband in less than 18 months, both sons in the same regiment, and would appear that they had joined together around the same time. So they're both in the Queen's Royal West Surrey Regiment, L8787 and L8040. So they would have joined pretty much on the same day.
It's incredibly sad when you hear that, you know, this particular lady you're talking about has lost her whole family. The fact that you are able to light the graves on Remembrance Sunday is an extremely precious thing to be able to do, to remember these people that who otherwise could be forgotten.
Most definitely. It surprises me, actually, when people come to visit and they say, I didn't know this was here, or I didn't know that they were there. Well, they're not going to forget now. And when the families come in with the youngsters, we give all the children a little electric tea light, and we encourage them to go up to the top to the Cross of Sacrifice, and they put their light down there. That way, we're reminding the next generation that we must remember them. And that, to me, is the most important thing.
BFBS, the Forces Station.
I'm just part of a small team who really looks after the cemetery. My main role really is doing the applications for people who are applied to be buried. I also support when the families want to put memorials. I obviously go around and check and make sure the cemetery is in pristine condition. As you can see, it is.
John, tell us a little bit about the history.
Well, within Cyprus, 13 cemeteries which have recorded military burials of service personnel, and the earliest being 1878, to the latest, which is Dhekelia, which was opened in 1960 and was built due to the independence of Cyprus and what we know is the Eastern Sovereign Base area. But the first burial was an infant called Susan Frances Ballantyne, and she died in April 1960. But the first recorded service person's burial was a Lance Corporal Michael Allington, Royal Army Physical Corps, and that was in 1960. And the latest burial within the cemetery was a squadron leader, James Richard Wiley, Royal Air Force, and he was buried earlier this month. So there's ranks of all the three services, which is interned in the cemetery. Private Pillin, she was a Women's Signal Army Corps. She died at the age of 18 in 1967. And to the highest, a Colonel David Wright, DSO OBE, and he was Royal Army Medical Corps at the time. And he was actually the commanding officer of the British Military Hospital at Dhekelia at the time of his death. Numerous army regiments, Black Watch, Devon and Dorsets, the Gloucestershire Regiment, Royal Engineers, Parachute Regiment, Royal Irish, Life Guards, and one particular person of interest for myself is a Sergeant Owen Folkes. He was Royal Welsh Fusiliers, and that's the battalion I joined when I first joined the army, and he was a part of the United Nations Forces in Cyprus, and he died in 1966. But it's not just sovereign-based personnel buried here. We've also had multinational support given to the operations in Cyprus over the years. And we've also Canadian Forces personnel who died whilst on the United Forces in Cyprus operations. And they've been laid to rest, and their graves continue to be maintained. And as you can see, we've got the Canadian flags, and they're refreshed every year by the Royal British Legion and Larnaca branch. Records indicate some of them died while serving here. Some have died during the United Nations in Forces Cyprus. A period of time.
Looking at the graves, there are quite a few where there's infants and children buried. Can you tell me a little bit about that, John?
As you can see, they've been marked with a flag, or some have been also marked with like a teddy bear. We also have a memorial garden, and that is sadly for the stillbirth infants who died between 1984 and 1985, because unfortunately we don't know where their graves are. We're creating that multi-phase memorial garden. That's an ongoing project, and that allows then the families to at least go to somewhere to remember the children.
Does it take a lot to maintain this site?
Yes, but it's an enduring task. I've been to some cemeteries in the past, and I've not seen anything as beautiful as this, and they're constantly on top of it. Unfortunately, last October we had a pretty bad storm in the area, which caused numerous trees to fall. But again, with some form of collaboration, they were able to quickly turn this around. It's a lot of work, but they're constantly on top of it. And as you can see, it's quite an amazing place, and they just make it look easy.
I mean, this must be quite an interesting part of your job. Obviously, a very sad part of your job.
I think it's an honour and a privilege to do something like this. It's something that when I first joined the army, I never thought I would do. But it is interesting. I like helping people, and this is an example where I can help people at a time of need, I suppose, when they've lost a loved one, and I can then show them what I can do and to help them with that.
3,000 miles away from home, alongside the Persian Gulf, marking remembrance in Bahrain can feel a little bit different. Here in the capital city, Manama, is the old Christian cemetery. 72 of the graves here looked after by the Commonwealth War Graves Commission. And this is where I met Alistair Long, British ambassador to Bahrain.
In this cemetery, we have a number of British forces personnel buried, airmen, naval officers, army officers. And it's wonderful to be able to come back here and remember them as we do all the fallen around the 11th of November. This is a place of incredible history between the UK and Bahrain. It was the centre from 1946 to 71 of British decisions about the whole of this part of the world. And I think what you see is the service that individuals have contributed to that history by standing in a place like this, remembering where we've come from, remembering that their sacrifice has enabled us to be here today in this peaceful way, enjoying an amazing relationship with Bahrain, which still supports, you know, a naval base that's doing good things in the region today. That all comes off the back of these people who've been part of that story.
And it's quite apt we're seeing that. If we just look to our right now, you can see the gravestones there, one Royal Engineer and one Airman, both kind of attributed on their gravestone to HMS Dufair. That's a very familiar name for anyone that's been around NSF in the last few years.
Yeah.
What do you think remembrance means today to serving personnel?
We have some 300 plus service people here in Bahrain doing amazing work. And I hope that they can feel, as they work alongside the Bahrainis, that deep sense of history. The many people before them who've made the many contributions to this part of the world and Bahrain has made to our own country, and feel a part of something much bigger.
As we walked around the cemetery, it was quite strange to feel such a sort of peaceful state in the heart of a busy city. The call to prayer going off as it does around this time of day in the background, and a member of staff walking around helping to clean up the graves and keep the headstones maintained. It just feels like such a significant moment of recognition on a weekday morning. At the back of the cemetery is a brick structure with a tiled roof and iron gates. Now, this was erected in 1993 to commemorate the dead of two world wars, and this usually would have been the centre point of the Remembrance Day service that's held here. Over the past few years, though, this has been held at the British Embassy instead, and this year will actually be Alistair's first in Bahrain.
Ambassadors come and ambassadors go, but actually that continuity and that sense of the longevity of what the UK means for the world is I think really important. Again, we're going to be under the trees. We'll stand together with all the ambassadors here, many of our Bahraini friends, and we'll reflect not only on the world wars of the 20th century and all the conflicts since, but we'll reflect on some of the conflicts of today that we're sadly witnessing. I do still look back on the world wars and think, nonetheless, we learnt some valuable lessons from that period, and that the 20th century could have been a far bleaker period if it weren't for the sacrifice that those brave people made.